This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
On September 17th, 1920, 14 men crammed into a car auto showroom in Canton, Ohio, and changed the sports world forever. There weren't enough chairs for everybody to sit, and there was cigar smoke as thick as the eye can see. And they sat on running boards and drank beer out of buckets. It was prohibition, but they didn't care. None of them knew it, but they were about to change the way we thought about football and turn what would become the National Football League into a $200 billion a year business. This is a story of how professional football was organized and born. In a showroom next to Hupmobiles and Jordan touring cars, this is where it all began. In 1920, American football was not professional. It belonged to the colleges, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Notre Dame. These were the names that filled the sports pages. College games drew 50,000 to sometimes 80,000 fans on a Saturday afternoon. The professional game, well, it was a disorganized afterthought. A circuit of town teams, factory clubs, and sandlot squads scattered across Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, and Western New York, playing in front of crowds that sometimes numbered maybe in the hundreds. And the professional game had three problems, each feeding the others like a fever. First, there were spiraling salaries. With no league to enforce contracts, players jumped from team to team, chasing the highest offer, sometimes switching allegiances between Saturday and Sunday. A star halfback might play for Massillon one week and Akron the next, wearing a different jersey each time. Second, there was the college poaching scandals that were going on. There was so many times where the professional teams would pay players under assumed names that were collegians. They were trying to make an extra buck just to get through school. Newt Rockne himself, later the legendary Notre Dame coach, reportedly played for multiple professional teams under fake names while still a student. The colleges fumed but could not stop it. Third, there was no order, no fixed schedules, no standings, no championship, no rules that bound anyone to anything. Seasons started when a team felt like starting, ended when it ran out of opponents or money, and championships were claimed by whoever shouted the loudest. Something had to give, and the man that did it was an automobile showroom owner, a man named Ralph Hay. Ralph Edward Hay was not a football visionary. He was a businessman from Canton, Ohio, who had purchased the Canton Bulldogs in 1918 at the age of 27. A team that had once been the pride of the Ohio League. He had saw what was happening. The salary wars were bleeding owners dry. The college scandals threatened to poison the sport entirely. If professional football was going to survive, someone had to bring order to the chaos. On August 20th, 1920, Hay invited the owners of three other Ohio teams to his office, the Akron Pros, the Cleveland Tigers, and the Dayton Triangles. Four men, four teams. One afternoon, they hammered out three principles that would change the sports forever. First was no signing of college players until after graduation. Secondly, no bidding on players that were playing for another team. Third, maybe a salary cap. There would be a maximum for what players could be paid by teams to try to keep the playing field a little bit even for all of the franchises. They called themselves the American Professional Football Conference, and they agreed one more thing. This had to be bigger than Ohio. Hay was tasked with reaching out to every other major professional team in the country, and he did. Letters went out to Hammond, Muncie, Rock Island, Decatur, Racine, Rochester, Buffalo, Detroit. 11 teams were invited, and all of them said yes. A second meeting was set September 17, 1920. Same city, same building, but this time, Hay's office would not be big enough for what was about to happen. 15 men arrived by rail and bus that Friday evening, more than Hay expected. His second floor office in the Oddfellows building could not hold them. So they moved down to the ground floor into the automobile showroom. The room was large enough for four cars, Hupmobiles and Jordans, the pride of Hay's dealership. Chairs were few, and George Hallis, the young player coach of the Decatur Steelers, sat on a running board. Others perched on fenders, leaned on hoods, or stood in the smoke. Halas later wrote in his autobiography, quote, "The showroom, big enough for four cars, occupied the ground floor of three-story old brick Oddfellows building. Chairs were few, and I sat on a running board," end quote. Hay placed buckets of beer on the floor, cigars were lit, and the minutes were taken on a typewriter somewhere in a haze. And over the course of that evening, those 14 men did the following. They renamed their organization the American Professional Football Association. They set a $100 membership fee per team. In a detail that would later become legend, Halas later confessed, "I can testify that no money exchanged hands. The fee was theater in an attempt to project legitimacy." And then they made the most inspired publicity move in the history of professional sports. They elected a president, and his name was Jim Thorpe. No American athlete had ever been so famous as Jim Thorpe was. He was a budding superstar, a star at Carlisle in football and baseball. He went to the 1912 Olympics and won gold medals, where the King of Sweden said that he was the greatest athlete in the world. And he was probably right. He had led the Carlisle Indian School to one of the greatest upsets in college football history in his playing days. He had played Major League Baseball for the New York Giants, and his name was on the marquee. It really meant something. So when the owners of the APFA looked around that smoky showroom and asked who should lead their fledgling league, the answer was obvious. Thorpe was elected unanimously. Here's the paradox, and it's a perfect parable for what professional football was in 1920. Jim Thorpe was the face of the league, and yet he barely played in it. He was a president in name only, a ceremonial figure whose job was to make the APFA look respectable. The real organizing work fell to men like Ralph Hay, Joe Carr, the Columbus Panhandles, and George Halas, who understood that the survival of pro football depended not on star power, but on structure of a league. Thorpe would suit up for a few games with Canton Bulldogs that season, but his presidency was a symbol. And symbols matter, especially when you're trying to convince a skeptical public that your sport is not just a collection of mercenaries playing under fake names. The APFA now had a name, a president, and a $100 fee that nobody had paid. What it did not have was a schedule, a championship, or any real idea what it just had created. The 1920 APFA season was, to put it mildly, unstructured. Each team arranged its own schedule. Some played 13 games. Others played one. The Muncie Flyers played exactly a single league contest, a 45-0 loss to Rock Island on October 3rd. They never played another APFA game, and they folded at the end of the season. This was the reality of the first professional football league. Survival was not guaranteed. This was the reality of professional football. As a matter of fact, of those 14 teams that met in 1920, only two of them survive in any form today. The Racine Cardinals, named after the Chicago street and not the Wisconsin city, became the Chicago Cardinals, later the St. Louis Cardinals, the Phoenix Cardinals, and today are the Arizona Cardinals, the oldest continuously operating franchise in professional football. Then there were the Decatur Staleys, you know, that George Halas team. They were a team sponsored by A.E. Staley, a factory team for his starch company, and they were founded in Decatur, Illinois, later moved to Chicago. The franchise given fully over to Halas, who later turned them into the Chicago Bears just a few years later. The first official game between two APFA teams was played on October 3rd, 1920 at Triangle Park in Dayton, Ohio. The Dayton Triangles defeated the Columbus Panhandles 14-0, and Lou Partlow of Dayton scored the first touchdown in league history. A crowd of roughly 4,000 watched the game. No one recorded the exact number, and no one really knew that it would matter. The championship race was just as chaotic as the schedule. No standings were officially kept, and by December, most teams had given up hope of a title. Some had already dissolved, but four teams remained in contention: Akron, Buffalo, Canton, and Decatur. A series of late games among them settled nothing definitively, except that the Akron Pros had finished undefeated with 8 wins, 0 losses, and 3 ties. They had only allowed 7 points the entire season, seven. And on their roster was a man named Fritz Pollard, a 5'9", 165-pound dynamo halfback out of Brown University, who had been named an All-American in college and a first-team All-Pro in his inaugural season. Pollard and Bobby Marshall of the Rock Island Independents were the first two black players in what would become the NFL. And Pollard would go on to become the league's first black head coach in 1921. In a sport that would later exclude black players entirely from 1934 to 1946, the first season was quietly and perfectly integrated. At a league meeting on April 30th, 1921, the owners voted to award the championship to Akron. The trophy, the Brunswick Ball Calendar Cup, was presented at a meeting, and it was the only year the trophy was ever used. Decades later, it went missing and really hasn't never been found. When those 14 men walked through Ralph Hayes' showroom on that September night in 1920, they didn't realize what they had created. They thought they had formed a professional association, a loose agreement to stop poaching players and bring some order to scheduling. They had no idea that they just planted a seed of one of the most powerful sports leagues in American history. The numbers make the point more dramatically than any narration could. In 1920, the Akron Pros won the championship in front of a few thousand fans playing in a league that didn't even keep the official standings. A century later, the Super Bowl is watched by more than 120 million people annually, and the NFL generates more than $20 billion in annual revenue. But the deeper legacy goes far beyond that. It's structural. Every principle those men debated in that showroom, salary rules, player contracts, and keeping kids in college playing football, those are practiced today, and the laws were expanded and rules were more defined as things went on. And that's what makes it special, that definitive line between college football and pro football, where both of those sports thrive, but the NFL really exceeded after 1958. Make sure you check out that piece we did last week on the 1958 championship game, and that'll bring a little bit more clarity along with some other ones that we'll have coming up here. They were making it up as they went, but what they did was really set the playing field level to make growth happen in a sport that would be attracted to millions around the world. The American Professional Football Association changed its name in 1922 to the National Football League. The presidency of Jim Thorpe, well, that was handed over to a man named Joe Carr that we talked about of the Columbus Panhandles that organized that team. And he really put structure and organizational skills into play into the National Football League, setting rules, setting that hard line when it had to be, and making schedules and player contracts be official. Ralph Hayes never made it to the Hall of Fame, at least not yet. And neither did most of the men in that room, but every Sunday in autumn, when 70,000 people fill a stadium and millions more watch from their living rooms, they're living inside a house that 14 men built between a Hutmobile and a Buick in a dealership in Canton, Ohio. Next time on the Gridiron Timeline, we travel back to 1925 and the Pottsville Maroons and Red Grange, the Galloping Ghost of Illinois, who turned professional football into an experience that fans really wanted to encapsulate and witness. You know, Red Grange has had some great moments and brought some thrills to the college game. But what he did for the professional game, even though he wasn't starring at too many places, that 1925 season was special and really brought the NFL into its own. So make sure you check that out next week. We'll have some shorts on and visit our timeline, pigskindispatch.com. Till next time, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.